I'm Oscar Nordstrom, host of the new and talked about show Off the Beaten Path on talkradio.nyc. We'll be on live each Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. First, I'd like to thank Sam Leibowitz of the Conscious Consultants Hour for his kind introduction. This week's show will be really special, not that my others weren't, but today we'll feature the last in a series of lectures given by the spirit of Dr. Albert Einstein. On my earlier shows, Dr. Einstein explained his theories about time and space, as well as how he formulated the world's most famous equation, E equals mc squared. Today we'll recap those lectures and conclude with why gravity isn't just a force of attraction, but rather a warping of space-time. Our show will include the usual thought for the day, this one from Benjamin Franklin, and continue with a new feature where I recount a true story from a sports figure immortal. Today's story will be about what the unforgettable Casey Stengel told sports writers when asked to explain the secret of his managerial success. I'll then continue with another weekly staple, memorable stories about American heroes. I have one more story for you about Benjamin Franklin, whose homespun humor was instrumental in gaining France's support for the American Revolution. I'll also be discussing the highly controversial subject of religion and politics. If you listen to any of my earlier shows, you know that I am not one to shrink from discussing controversial issues, such as why I see college campuses turn from forums for open discussion to isolationist centers for social protest, and reminiscent of George Orwell's book of 1984. Over the past few weeks, I also took issue with those who were the famed American's founding fathers, and even the navigator Christopher Columbus, who discovered the islands in the Caribbean by accident while looking for a shorter route to India. This week, I'll be discussing why we should not judge figures like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson by today's mores and standards. Please do call or email me with your questions or comments. Unless I hear from you, I won't know whether the stew needs more water or more salt. The phone number here is 877-480-4120, and welcome. I'd like to start today's show by completing a few things that I had been talking about when time ran out last week. The first thing being on the subject of abortion. If you were listening last week, you heard me explain why I thought the Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, was an injustice, as it had intervened in an ongoing process whereby the states were ratifying women's abortion rights. In fact, 13 had already passed legislation legalizing abortion, and many others were not enforcing their own laws. I said I also believe the Supreme Court had overstepped its duties and responsibilities as defined in the Bill of Rights, well, actually in the Constitution, and that there was no means for checking the power of the Supreme Court, which it had been constituted to check the powers of the executive and legislative branches of the government. It did this by subjecting their actions to compliance with the powers given them by the Constitution. But once the Supreme Court rendered a decision, there was little anyone could do to change it, even should both sides of an issue wish to do so. I continue by saying that I generally support women's rights in this regard. I believe that had the matter been settled in the state's ratification or by the legislature, this would have prevented the ongoing battle in the state courts over the issue of states' rights, women's rights, the potentiality of the fetus. I wanted to conclude this by saying, my object was to shed more light on the subject and give pause to those who believe that social issues are best decided by seeking redress in the courts whose makeup may be more favorable to their side, and that courts that reach decisions based on political or social leanings are not serving justice, nor are they benefit to either party in the long run. Witnessing the continuing debate and litigation that's been created between the pro-life and pro-choice movements in our country. On the earlier show, I also discussed the fact that Supreme Court and lower courts appear to be disregarding another fundamental right guaranteed to those of faith in the Constitution. I wrote about this in a section of my book, Fountain of Change, titled Jesus Reconciles the Laws of God and Man. The story was taken from chapter 22 of Matthew's Gospel. There, Jesus is publicly asked by a group of Pharisees if it was legal to pay census tax to the Romans. The question is a loaded one intended to trap Jesus, who was seen by the Jewish leaders of his day as a heretic. The reason Jesus was asked the question is that the payment of taxes to the Romans was against the Jewish law. But publicly stating so would have led, could have led to his arrest on the charge of sedition against the Roman occupiers. Jesus responds by taking by asking for a coin in which to use to pay the census tax. And the request reminded me of how Jesus handled other confrontations similarly, including how he answered a challenge of by what authority he had assaulted priests in the great temple of Jerusalem, and how he prevented a stoning of an adulterous woman who was should have been stoned by Jewish law as well. In each instance, his initial response was what I see as an extremely clever misdirection, as it diverted the attention of the group from their intended purpose, thereby diminished their immediate anger and passion, as they were forced to wait for his answer. In this instance, the delay was in the group's inability to quickly produce the coin Jesus had asked for, which would have been a Roman denarius. The use of foreign money was forbidden within the confines of the great temple where the confrontation takes place. When one is finally produced, Jesus holds it aloft and asks whose likeness is on it. The answer comes to him from the group, Caesar, to which Jesus replies, "Then repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God." While his response may seem rather uninspired, the answer was perfect. First, as it delayed the crowd while they sought to find the coin, and by producing it, it was an admission that they too were paying the census tax and couldn't very well then tell Jesus that he was breaking the law. In fact, I suggest that the question posed by the Pharisees and Jesus' response can be likened to our founders' debate of the separation of church and state. An issue of great importance, given that many of nation's early settlers had come to escape religious persecution. The issue was of such significance that it was addressed in the First Amendment of the Constitution, to wit, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. When Thomas Jefferson, who I'll talk about a little later, one of our Constitution's framers, was asked to explain the intent of the First Amendment, he wrote that it was done to create, and I quote, a wall of separation between the church and state, end quote, which assuredly meant that neither should infringe on the rights of the other. And as I see it, this is part of the acrimony that exists between those who are on one the religious issue, which on one side see that their rights are being attacked, and on the other side that sees that what's being done is an infringement on strongly held religious beliefs. And if you don't think that religious groups have anything to gripe about, consider how the Little Sisters of the Poor feel about being legally compelled to pay for abortion pills for their employees, something which has gone through the courts and remains there. And for this reason, I strongly believe and have said in a formal enactment affecting either group should have been addressed through the legislature or by a consensus of the individual states, such as in the case of the Equal Rights Amendment, which is currently winding its way through the court system, through the states. And it finally appears getting close to being ratified by the 38 states necessary to have it become the law of the land. While a long time coming, the process has allowed for amendments to be considered and modified to reflect the concerns of the population of each state. While some don't see why it should take so long to enact new laws, it took almost 7 years for our Constitution to be written and fully ratified, and during the process, 10 amendments were introduced, becoming the Bill of Rights, with each requiring ratification by 3/4 of the states. Unfortunately, this process is denied where 9 justices of the Supreme Court supplant the wisdom of the country as a whole. I want to repeat that. What happens when the Supreme Court reaches decision, when the decision would better be reached or could have been better addressed to the legislature or to states' rights, that by doing that, they are replacing the will of the people, which should really have made the decision. Also, our Constitution was drawn in such a manner as to protect the rights of each state so that bigger populated states could not control the entire country. This is why the use of the Electoral College, we have the use of the Electoral College to elect presidents. And perhaps even more polarizing, both groups are upset when they view the vagaries of the judicial system, whose decisions are often seen through the prism of one side's point of view, as well as seeming to be more the product of the court's makeup than wise judicial review. And many times the decisions are viewed from the standpoint of whose ox got gored, rather than from the realization that one side's gain is the other's loss. Frankly, I think we'd all be better served if the courts were less active. I now want to move, and I wanted to complete this by saying, and I think the best way that we can begin to heal what's going on in our nation is by recognizing that we are all members of the same human race and must show respect for each other, particularly where our beliefs and practices are different from each other. And then we must let our objectives be co-opted by radical elements in both factions, as I believe that the majority on both sides of the abortion or the religious rights issues do empathize with the other's views. I'm going to conclude this segment with something Martin Luther King once said, which I'm repeating from last week. Darkness cannot overcome darkness. Only light can do that. And hate cannot overcome hate. Only love can do that. And I don't believe Dr. King was referring to the nighttime when he was talking about darkness. I believe he was referring to those who would avoid hearing any voice but their own. I'm going to move on to a new staple on Off the Beaten Path, a story from our nation's sports annals. I see it's almost time to take a break, so before I get started with that, we'll take a break now. You're listening to Off the Beaten Path, Oscar Nordstrom. Please stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Want to connect with?
Are you an entrepreneur or intrapreneur looking to build your following?
Welcome to our show.
Follow me Friday with Joan
and Priya.
Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern
on talkradio.nyc.
We're your digital connectors.
Woo woo!
What's that?
Talking Alternative Radio. 24 hours a day.
Hi, welcome back. It's Oscar Nordstrom off the beaten path on Talk Radio. NYC. I left off on the last segment that I wanted to talk on this segment about a sports figure. As I have in my earlier shows, I talked about Heroes of American Past as well as many other topics, but I thought I should include something of a bit lighter each week. And being a student of sports, among other things, I thought that I should include, well, last week I included a story about how Joe Namath's memorable guarantee that the upstart New York Jets would defeat the heavily favored Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. And I talked about the fact that there are other memorable sayings that have come down to us. And I think one of them, or a few of them, came from somebody who that was known as the old professor, better known to New York Yankee and Met fans as Casey Stengel, who came out of retirement at the age of 72 to become the Mets' first manager in 1962. By the way, it was Casey who tabbed the bumbling team, the Amazons. Many believe that Casey Stengel's unique way of talking was instrumental in the amazing start the fans' support the team got, even though they lost 100 games the first year. A few of his more memorable lines include, "The only thing worse than watching a Mets game," now I'm talking about 1962, "is watching a Mets doubleheader. The one I like best is," he says, "see that fellow over there? He's 20. And in 10 years, he has a chance to be a star. Now, the other fellow over there, he's also 20. And in 10 years, he has a chance to be 30. But is best known for sayings that don't quite make any sense, like, "There comes a time in every man's life, and I've had plenty of them." The story you could, the story I'm going to tell you, and you could look it up. I think that's another one of his expressions. You could look it up. Was about Casey Stengel, how he became the manager of the New York Yankees in 1949. After a lackluster performance, and very short-lived, as a manager in the major leagues. At the time that he was chosen to be the manager of the Yankees, who were at that time very old and an injured team that weren't given much of a chance to win, to get into the playoffs the following, in 1949. When he was hired, it reminded me of when 1996, any New York fans will remember, that when the Yankees hired the Joe Torre, he was known as Clueless Joe. But Clueless Joe, as Casey Stengel, went on to win a lot of World Series for New York. But anyhow, this story of Casey Stengel is that when he was hired, he instituted things that weren't done at that time with this old team that was injured. He introduced a platoon system where he'd bat right-hand batters against left-hand pitchers and vice versa. He'd also remove better hitting players for good fielders late in the game and even replace starting pitchers with pinch hitters, which was unknown at the time. It wasn't, just wasn't done. And because of this, basically the older players hated him. But somehow or other, he pulled the team through that year and they won the 1949 World Series and the next four in a row from 1949 to 1953. And he actually won 10 World Series in his tenure overall, an amazing feat. But anyhow, at some point, I'm not sure exactly when, it might have been when they would nominate or designate him as for sports, the Best Manager of the Year award. He was out at a dinner, and he gave a speech, which I heard, which basically was so full of anecdotes and sidebars and other things, nobody could understand what he was saying. And it just cracked everybody up. But at one point, there came a point to answer questions. And so one of the questions was, one of the sports writers said, "Casey, to what do you owe this unbelievable record that you have?" And he says the following: "I managed to keep the players who hate me separated from the ones who haven't made up their mind yet." So that was Casey Stengel for you. Anyhow, I'm going to continue with the sports legend next week. And somebody who was once said, it was great, for known for his prowess, was also known for his use of the English language. And in fact, at one time, he said, "I never said the things I said." And I'm talking about Lawrence Peter Yogi Berra. And next week, I'm going to tell you some stories that I think you'll find very amusing about who played, by the way, for many, many years under Casey Stengel. I want to move on now and move on to the segment where I talk about Benjamin Franklin. Over the past few weeks, I talked a bit about Benjamin Franklin, the importance to our to the founding of our country. Benjamin was more than a famous scientist and an inventor. He was a highly respected author, publicist, printer, political theorist, politician, civic activist, statesman, and diplomat. His untiring efforts to unite the colonies led him to becoming known at the time as the first American. He believed in America's founding spirit of independence, and he had a strong sense of civic duty. In addition to being one of the founders, he was first president of what, in addition to being the founders, he was also first president of what became known as the University of Pennsylvania. And Franklin established or improved libraries, hospitals, volunteer fire departments, and a host of other things, and was our first, as our first postmaster general, helped establish our post office system. Moreover, he is only one of three of the founding fathers who participated in the drafting of the country's Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, and its first 10 amendments. And he was also our first ambassador to France, and was instrumental in our treaties with France and later with England, where he participated in the peace negotiations. Franklin was a skilled diplomat, and aside from France and England, he negotiated treaties with Germany, Sweden, and Spain, and was instrumental in America becoming recognized as an independent nation. Walter Isaacson, whose biography of Franklin was on the basis of much of my recollections, said of Franklin, Franklin was the most accomplished American of his age and the most influential in inventing the type of a society that America would become. By the way, aside from writing a best-selling biography of Franklin and of Albert Einstein as well, Isaacson was once chairman and CEO of CNN. No starch-shirted conservative was he. Anyway, the first two stories I wanted to tell you about today was an anecdote that Benjamin Franklin told about opinions. That's the first one. He said, this is a story that he told. He said that there was a man who and took his son and they traveled with a donkey. For a time, the man rode the donkey, and people who saw him complained that why was he making the child walk? So he got off the donkey and let the child ride. And then others complained that he was spoiling the child, and he should let the young boy walk, and he should ride the donkey. So not knowing what to do, he got on the donkey with the boy, only to have others complain that the poor donkey was being mistreated. So in the windup, the man threw the donkey off the next bridge they came to. So that's and the moral of the story is clearly, don't let anyone see your ass. Now, I just made that up. I don't know if you got a laugh or not. The second story is about how Franklin increased the circulation of his newspaper, which became the most popular in the colonies and was even read in England, by printing salacious letters he had written himself, using pseudonyms like Silence Dogwood, Martha Careful, Anthony Afterweight, and Celia Shortface. The one I liked best was a series of letters written by a Miss Polly Baker, who was being tried as a prostitute. During the trial, she threw herself on the mercy of the court, saying that she had been wronged by a man who turned out to be married. Having no means to support herself and her baby, she had to resort to prostitution, which led to her having more sons and more children. She pointed out that in the process she had raised a number of fine sons in service to the Republic and was proud of each and every one of them. Miss Baker's letters, like many of Franklin's, were aimed at the unfair treatment of the lower and working classes. In this case, it was to call attention to a law that punished a woman for prostitution while letting the man involved off scot-free. By the way, the term scot-free, the word scot comes from the Old Norse for payment, later used by the English to mean simply tax. So, in case you were interested, that's where scot, getting off scot-free, came from. Anyway, her story was so moving that the readers on both sides of the ocean couldn't wait to hear the next letter. The last letter Miss Baker wrote was that the jury was so moved by her story that they voted not guilty. And the judge was even more moved because he proposed to Polly right after her acquittal. I want to end these stories on Benjamin Franklin with the fact that he started out his rise to prominence as a 17-year-old escaped indentured servant. He, like many Americans, were consigned to this form of slavery referred to as indentured servitude. While most were much better off than African slaves of the British introduced into the colonies, they too were subject to punishment in prison and returned to their owners when caught. Further, like many of the time, including George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, who I'll talk about in a little while, Franklin himself owned slaves, which he later emancipated. And when the current cabal of history police finish off their attempts to denigrate Washington and Jefferson, they can then start on other slave owners from our founding fathers. Among them was, besides Franklin, John Hancock, Patrick Henry, and John Jay, who was our first Justice of the Supreme Court, and finally James Madison, who was a principal architect of our Constitution. And I'm going to be speaking of Thomas Jefferson and Washington first, and any others similarly, I think, bear more discussion than what's apparently going on one side of the issue. As I said in earlier broadcasts, slavery in one form or other has been around with us since the rise of civilization and only began to be looked on by the Western society as a great and hideous crime in the past few hundred years. And though many of our fathers saw slavery as a violation of the ideals on which the country was founded, their commitment to the principles of limited government and the need to make peace, if you will, with southern states that relied on slave-based agriculture stopped them from banning slavery until the Republican Party under Abraham Lincoln voted it into law in 1865 under the 13th Amendment. I feel a sense of duty to expose these history police for what they are, as well as their thinly disguised attempt to debase our country by cherry-picking facts in an effort to rewrite our history books and denigrate our proud heritage. I'll have more to say us in a few minutes, but I see that Dr. Einstein is losing patience, so I better get on with introducing his segment. In the prior three shows, Dr. Einstein was kind enough to explain through me his theory of special relativity that set forth the radical concept that neither time nor space were fixed, but depended on how they were being observed. In the last show, Dr. Einstein explained the basis for his equation E equals mc squared, and he's returning today to complete these explanations of his theory of relativity by discussing why gravity is not a force, but rather a warping of time-space. We're going to rely on some of these earlier discussions to lay the groundwork for this. Am I on the beam so far in what I'm saying, Doctor?
Yeah. Nicht so schwer. Für einen Dummkopf. Aber ich muss ihn jetzt sagen.
Doctor, it's tut mir leid. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I think the listeners are having trouble again with your accent.
Mein accent ist sehr gut, aber yours ist misschugener.
Ich verstanden. I mean, I understand, but the words are coming out of my mouth, and I'm doing the best I can.
Okay. You do this, Frecken. But don't glue it up.
Okay, Doctor, I won't glue it up. The first thing we must remind our listeners of is that we established in last week's that energy and mass are two different states of the same thing, like water and steam. And one of the properties of mass is that it exerts an attraction or pull on other objects. And when Dr. Einstein began to focus on his principle, he came to the question of what is this attraction we call gravity? And what's caused by the why is mass drawing another object towards it? As he pondered this, it came to him that gravity was a lot like acceleration. In fact, he realized that if you were in a rocket being fired into space, you would feel gravity pushing you get back against your seat. And if that rocket would begin to fall back to Earth with its cone nose facing down, you would be pushed back in your seat and could feel the same force that had you feel when you were accelerating upwards. This idea led to Dr. Einstein questioning what force could be feel the same as if you were falling or if you were going upward. I'm not sure how he made the connection and when this had to do with the conclusion he reached. Perhaps he likened it to being a train moving ahead at high speed and its absorption of kinetic energy from the outside itself. Don't forget that matter and energy can be neither created nor destroyed. I'm going to stop now because we're coming to a break shortly, and I wanted to continue with it after the break. And thanks again for listening. This is Oscar Nordstrom on talkradio.nyc, and you're listening to Off the Beaten Path. Thank you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
If you have an interest in marijuana, you want to know about marijuana, law, policy, and culture, then feel free to join me, Joseph A. Bondi, every Friday at 11 o'clock in the morning on my show, In the Know 420 on TalkingAlternative.com.
Hi, this is Rob Kay.
And I'm Callie Alpert.
And we're hosts of the Rob and Callie Show. Are you looking for a show that talks about real stuff like life, love, the pursuit of being yourself?
Then you have come to the right place because we cover topics ranging from chivalry to gratitude to your relationship with money and everything in between.
So listen to us on the Rob and Callie Show Tuesdays, 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on talkradio.nyc.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Hi, and welcome back. You're listening to Oscar Nordstrom on Off the Beaten Path on talkradio.nyc. Before we took the break, we were talking about Dr. Einstein and how he envisioned how that gravity is really a force that warps time-space. And where we were at was that he thought about the Earth like a train, which had both mass and energy. Both the Earth and a train, moving train, had both mass and energy. And that because it has mass and energy, it can attract other forms of energy or mass, including other planets or even light, causing it to bend. Think of it this way. When a train passes or a car passes you at high speed, you feel a suction being pulled towards it. Now, it's not the same force, but the concept is kind of the same. Here's a planet rushing through space and drawing kinetic energy from around it. It can't create it, so it has to draw it from other things. So it's actually sucking in energy and mass, or trying to, from other sources. Einstein concluded that one of the properties of mass is that it can even pull light out of a straight course. Einstein used this idea to explain why astrologists had found that the location of the planet Pluto, now demoted to a dwarf planet, was not where the Newtonian laws said it should be. By using the math that factored in the effect of gravity on light, Dr. Einstein showed that the Pluto ended up being exactly where it should be. And when Einstein applied this theory to light, he realized that anything that was within the influence of an object could be similarly drawn to it. And if light was being warped, so too must time and space. Remember how Dr. Einstein proved that time and space were not fixed, but were altered or warped, if you will, by motion. That was my first. That was the first show that we had Dr. Einstein on. And scientists. I think I got ahead of myself here. Forgive me one second. Okay, here we are. Scientists have recently explained that this theory by comparing the effect we call gravity to the placement of an object like a bowling ball on a sheet of rubber, which is analogous to the Earth and the space around it. The weight or mass of the bowling ball stretches or warps the rubber sheet. However, the effect is not one-dimensional. It's in all directions. After Dr. Einstein published his theory of relativity, it was greeted by a great deal of skepticism by the scientific community, until it was proven 4 years later when, in 1919, a group of English scientists took photographs of a solar eclipse from two different places on Earth, and by comparing them, discovered that the sun was actually bending the light rays which had been traveling from a star. Other experiments over the years have continued to prove that Einstein's theory is spot on. Doctor, have I explained your theory of relativity as well as I'm able to? No, it's just better than Duncan Hospital for somebody that's not a physicist. When this want to Dagenzane, I want to say Dunkazane, for giving me the opportunity to make my ideas more fallible to the common schnook. I mean common falcon. Well, Doctor, I can only say that it's been a great honor to host you, and I want to thank you on behalf of all of us, not only for your insights into the nature of the universe, but for your humanity as well. Please do come back or call in any time you want. Yeah. If you like to kind of go back in the time and discover things like, warum the dinosaurs become extinct? As a famous motion picture star, Humphrey Bogart sagen, and the famous movie, Mikasa Sukasa, this could be the start of some Shona friendship, Oscar. I think he was talking about Casablanca, Doctor. But anyway, thank you so much for being on the show, and thanks again. And come back any time that you want to. I'd like to now turn to the American cabal, as I call it, of the history police, another name that I've given them, who are acting in the capacity of self-elected judge, jury, and executioner of legacies of famous Americans and others from the annals of history. A few weeks ago, I talked about the time I listened to a famous radio, New York radio sportscaster, Mike Francesa, on the way home from work. A caller asked him if he thought he could name what the greatest baseball role of all time was. Mike responded that he could only answer that question based on the era the player played in. Babe Ruth being the greatest ball player of the 20s, 1920s, perhaps the 30s, and Mickey Mantle of the 1950s. And I thought if most New York listeners would know that the Red Sox, Ted Williams, and not Joe DiMaggio was probably the greatest baseball player of the 40s, and an authentic war hero to boot. The point that Francesca made struck me as true for history figures as well. And just as our current generation could undoubtedly pick a current player over those who saw Mickey Mantle as the greatest, neither should the current history police judge any of our nation's founding fathers or any other historical figures, for that matter, based on today's standards and mores. A perfect example of this can be seen in how history police have denigrated our 33rd president, Harry S. Truman, who authorized the use of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which led to the end of World War II. Without considering the issues of what led to the use of this weapon, the history police have condemned Truman for what they see as a baseless and hideous act, never mind that the Japanese were guilty of far worse offenses, including slaughtering hundreds of thousands of unarmed Chinese civilians when they invaded the capital city of Nanking. If anyone took the trouble to know the facts around Truman's gut-wrenching decision, they could not help but empathize with the pressure he was under, nor could they say that he had much of a choice in the matter, given the many factors involved. Not the least of which was that the unimaginably far greater destruction and loss of lives the Japanese would have sustained, not to mention American lives, had we been forced to invade China. Truman's decision was based on Japan's determination not to surrender, but instead to resist a planned invasion by sacrificing the lives of its remaining soldiers and much of the civilian population, as it had in the last two major battles in World War II, in the Pacific, in Iwo Jima and Okinawa. In those two battles, the Japanese sacrificed virtually the entire 18,000-man garrison defending Iwo Jima and lost, they're not sure, between 77 and 110,000 troops and an estimated high as half the 300,000 civilian population of Okinawa. Between those two islands, the Japanese suffered more casualties than the estimated 100,000 Japanese who lost their lives as a result of the atomic bombs. In addition, the U.S. lost a combined 27,000 men killed in both battles and suffered an additional 75,000 casualties, most of whom would never be the same. If we extend those numbers to the estimated 4 million Japanese soldiers and 33 million civilians defending their homeland, one can only imagine the carnage that would have resulted in both sides had we been forced to invade China. Further, Truman had to consider that any further delay would have resulted in the petitioning of Japan by the Soviet Union, as had happened in Europe, as they were preparing to invade Japan as well. And while the history police want to cherry-pick historical facts to gain notoriety for themselves and their cause by asserting that the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was an indefensible atrocity, the fact that Truman won a decisive re-election long after the war speaks volumes to how Americans at the time felt about his decision. Interestingly, Winston Churchill, arguably the most important figure of the 20th century, did not fare so well, as he was dismissed by the Brits when he sought re-election at war's end. I am equally appalled by the attempt in the history police to denigrate our founding fathers, particularly George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. So let's examine the facts. While I'm sure most of the listeners know a bit about the man who had become known as the father of our country, I want to repeat some of the more important facts that made the presidential scholars and historians rank him as the second most important president in U.S. history after Abraham Lincoln. And it should not be a surprise that either one of these figures are depicted in our most used currency, nor that they are celebrated in major monuments in Washington and on Mount Rushmore as well. A bit about Washington. He was born in Virginia. His father, a wealthy landowner who owned tobacco plantations and slaves, whom George inherited when his father died at a young age of 48. George was a young and ambitious and brave young man who gained knowledge as a surveyor proved to be of good service to the British during the French and Indian Wars. And at a time when the average height of man was 5'8", Washington's 6'2" gave him a commanding presence, which no doubt helped him become one of the senior officers in the colonial militia. This experience and knowledge of British tactics certainly influenced the Continental Congress appointment of him to lead the colonial forces against England. And aside from his generalship, historians commend his almost uncanny ability to choose his generals, with whom he consulted frequently. Besides that, Washington was a great organizer whose attention to discipline and training, as well as to supplies and logistics, was instrumental in turning a group of independent militias, farmers, merchants, and woodsmen into a cohesive fighting force that defeated a much larger, seasoned, and better equipped British army. He also had the respect of the Continental Congress and state governors and their militia, as he would frequently communicate with them on the status of war and things that were needed. While at times he was outmaneuvered by the British, he always managed to avoid any major defeats which have resulted in the loss of the army. On one such occasion, they lost the Battle of New York when a local farmer showed the British troops in Long Island a path that no one else knew about that led them to surprise the American forces from the rear and rout them. And Washington was almost captured at the time. The true story I find most illuminating about the leadership, his leadership, is the men thought that he was invincible in battle, having had British 50 caliber musket balls shoot two horses out from under him and pass another four to his coats during battles. This bravery was significant to an army that had suffered defeat after defeat, until almost out of hope, he led his army across the Delaware River on Christmas night, an icy Delaware River, might add, and defeated the British at Trenton and later at Princeton, New Jersey. Those victories revitalized the colonies and was instrumental in gaining support of France. Following the defeat of the British at Yorktown in 1783, which ended the war, Washington resigned his commission and returned to his home in Mount Vernon, New York, Mount Vernon, Virginia. This was at a time when he was so popular he could have easily seized control of the country. And we've seen that many times throughout history, that people have, generals have seized the control of the country after a war. And he reluctantly came out of retirement to preside over the 1787 convention that was drafting the first U.S. Constitution. Widely admired for his strong leadership, he was unanimously elected as president by the Electoral College in his first two national elections, and could have probably stood for more, but he set what until FDR was a tradition of American presidents only serving two terms, which was enacted into law in the 1940s. Too bad they didn't set term limits on Congress and perhaps the Supreme Court as well at that time, something that they're never going to allow to happen any longer, which I think is really needed. And as the first president, Washington became the model for all presidents, even picking the title Mr. President when others proposed titles such as Your Highness and Your Excellency. He further established the tradition of an inaugural address and a cabinet system. Given all the personal sacrifices he made and his importance to the founding of our country, you may wonder why he's being denigrated today by the history police. The reason is Washington, like many of his day, was brought up in an era where slavery was part of the fabric of the agricultural South, and he inherited his father's slaves and lands. I'm going to take another break here. We'll be coming back shortly. You're listening to Off the Beaten Path. Thank you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you into comics, movies, and pop culture at large? What about music and TV? Then you're in for a treat. This is Michael Dolce, your host on TalkingAlternative.com. I've been professionally writing comic books, screenplays, and music articles for almost 15 years. Catch my show, Secrets of the Sire, at its new primetime slot, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and get the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. For more info, go to secretsofthesire.com.
Hello, this is Mark Torres.
And Pronto Comics' own Dominic Sperano.
And listen to our show, It Came From the Radio, right here on talkradio.nyc, every Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We talk about entertainment, movies,
comic books, and other news.
So make sure you check us out. That's right here, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, every Wednesday, talkradio.nyc.
TalkingAlternative.com.
Beaten path. Before we took a break, I talked about some of the things that made George Washington such a great commanding figure Revolutionary War, and became known so many as father of our country. And I talked about that people today see him as racist. Some do anyway, because he inherited land and slaves from his father. And I'm going to continue that discussion. Let's look at the fact behind George Washington's ownership of slaves. Firstly, while he and many of our founding fathers saw slavery as morally indefensible, they chose not to challenge it as they were afraid it would cause a separation and rift between the colonies at a time when unity was the most important and a key to independence. And that concern was not unfounded. Witness the Civil War that later occurred. And while not excusing Washington's use of slaves nor his allowance for their physical abuse at times, he never sold a slave against their will or where it would disrupt the family. This led to his having many more slaves than he wholly necessary. You might say big deal, but at the time it was something. He also allowed his slaves to learn a usable trade and grow crops on their own, perhaps in preparation for their freedom, which he bequeathed in his will. His wife Martha did that. She freed all of the slaves in 1800 following his death in December of 1799 from pneumonia. Washington was revered by his country in life and in death. He was eulogized by the father of Robert E. Lee, of all people, who was known as, he was a Major General Harry Lee III, who was earned the title Light Horse Harry for his daring as a cavalry officer in the Continental Army. It was Lee's father who said of Washington, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Despite all this, and the history police are now seeking to denigrate Washington as a racist. I also want to go on now and talk about Thomas Jefferson, who's been similarly convicted by the history police. Presidential scholars and historians, again, see Jefferson as one of our greatest presidents. As one of our founding fathers, he was a principal author of the Declaration of Independence and participated in the framing of our Constitution. You may recall in a recent show I described how he went to Benjamin Franklin when complaining bitterly how the Continental Congress made changes to the Declaration which he, Franklin, and John Adams had so painstakingly drafted. One of the changes made to the draft was the striking by the Southern delegates of Jefferson's criticism of King George III's role in promoting slavery in the colonies. And like Franklin and George Washington and many of the founding fathers, while he saw slavery as a violation of the ideals upon which the country was founded, his commitment to the principles of limited government and the need to ensure unity among the 13 colonies stopped him from attempting to do anything that could cause a schism in the country's southern states who relied on the slave-based agriculture. This and the fact that that Jefferson did not call for the slaves to be freed upon his death led to charges that he's a racist in the politically charged atmosphere of the 1960s and coming to date. More about this in a bit, but a bit about Jefferson himself. Jefferson was a true Renaissance man. He spoke several languages. He was an accomplished architect, to which his home Monticello attests, and he founded the University of Virginia, whose buildings and grounds he surveyed and also designed. He was also an accomplished in mathematics and horticulture and had a keen interest in philosophy and religion, which earned him presidency of the American Philosophical Society. And though not a religious man, he was heavily influenced by Christianity and deism. His many talents were recognized in 1962 at a dinner in the White House hosted by then-President John F. Kennedy to honor Nobel Peace Prize winners. The formal dinner was also attended by members of the president's cabinet, as well as the Norwegian ambassador and the Swedish minister. The president's opening remarks included the following. I lost my place again. Well, I'm going to ad-lib this bit. What he said was, ladies and gentlemen, the group of people we have here tonight is probably the most, the most prominent and well-known and well-thought people that ever sat in the White House, except when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. And he went on to describe the many qualities that Jefferson had. So President Kennedy thought a great deal about Jefferson. And I need to find my place here because I have to go on. Okay, here we are. And I found my place. I'll read it to you. I want to tell you how welcome you are at the White House. I think this is the most extraordinary collection of talent, of human knowledge, that has ever been gathered together in the White House, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. Someone once said that Jefferson was a gentleman of 32 who could calculate an eclipse, survey an estate, tie an artery, plan an edifice, try a cause, break a horse, or dance the minuet. So obviously, our president thought a lot about him. In addition to the many contributions that Jefferson made as one of our founding fathers, the one that stands out during his presidency, he was the third president, is his negotiation for the Louisiana Purchase with France, which immediately doubled the size of the colonies of our country's territory. Moreover, as president, he sponsored and later signed an act prohibiting the importation of slaves in 1807. This was a follow-up to earlier failed proposals in 1779 and 1784, where he sought the gradual emancipation of slaves, as he thought that while they had an innate human rights, neither they nor the country were then prepared for their immediate freedom. At one point, after numerous attempts and failures to bring in about emancipation, Jefferson wrote a letter in 1805 to William Burrell, who would later become his private secretary, saying, "I have long given up expectation of any early provision for the extinguishment of slavery among us." He also called out slavery in a letter that he wrote in notes to the state of Virginia. He called it a moral evil for which the nation would ultimately have to account to God. And while Jefferson was what has been described as a benevolent slave owner, there's no getting around the fact that he, as other wealthy Southern landowners, used slave labor, and he did, for his plantations, his home, and his workshops. In fact, Jefferson owned several plantations which worked hundreds of slaves, although some of them were purchased by Jefferson to unite families. And while not attempting to whitewash this, it is known that he had very liberal in his treatment of slaves, including the fact that he did not overwork them by the conventions of the time and gave them Sundays and Christmas off, and allowed them personal time in the non-growing season. He also provided them with log cabins, with fireplaces, food, clothing, and some household provisions, and allowed them to grow to have their own gardens and raise chickens to supplant their food supply. He also gave financial and other incentives as a reward, and forbid the use of a whip except for punishment in rare cases of stealing or fighting. Also, while his nail factories employed child slaves, many later became tradesmen. However, the fact that he did not emancipate his slaves upon his death, and for the most part was silent during this issue on his presidency, has resulted in some labeling him as a racist, along with the demand that his memorial be removed from Washington and his image removed from our currency. However, this overlooks the fact that his public debate during the administration had resulted in a dangerous North-South rift among the states, with talk of the Northern Confederacy in New England, a reality that came to pass less than 50 years following his death in the Civil War. Also, violent attacks by white slave owners on white slave owners and what became known as the Haitian Rebellion resulted in the end of French rule in Haiti. And this raised Jefferson's fears of a similar race war here, which further contributed to his reluctance to speak out against slavery. This fear was manifested in a letter that Jefferson wrote to George Logan, a friend and a senator from Pennsylvania. In the letter, Jefferson wrote, "I have most carefully avoided every public or act or manifestation on this subject." Due to these facts, current scholars remain divided on whether Jefferson could truly condemn slavery, with some finding convincing evidence that he was an opponent his entire life and did what he could in his limited options that were available to him. Witness his many attempts to pass legislation to curtail and ultimately abolish slavery. While others continue to denounce Jefferson as a racist for holding slaves and for his silence concerning this when they were his president, and because he never freed most of his slaves. However, that he only freed a handful of slaves can be attributed to a number of factors, not the least of which was a patriarchal belief that slaves were then incapable of supporting themselves and would become burdened on the state until they were able to do so. A fact that he saw in the state law in Virginia that required free slaves to leave Virginia within a year. One further point, following the death of his wife Martha in 1782, he fathered at least one child with his slave Sally Hemings, which was recently proven conclusively by DNA tests. I have a lot of final thoughts on this subject, but we're coming to the end of the show, and rather to get them started, I think I'd just like to end the show by kind of rephrasing some of the things that I had talked about very briefly. One of them is that the Supreme Courts and other courts, I feel, are interceding in the legislature and states' process of laws, and that it's harmful to the country in the long run. And I want to reiterate the fact that I think all of us need to have a little more tolerance for each other. Because at the end of the day, we're all Americans, and many of us, if we don't believe in God, believe that harming of other people is wrong. I think far and away the majority is, and I don't think we should be paying too much attention to the radicals on the left and right who say otherwise. And I'd like to thank you for listening. I'll pick up. I have some concluding remarks I want to end with next week. You've been listening to Oscar Nordstrom. Please stay tuned to David Weinberg on Is It Plugged In? I think you'll enjoy his show. Thanks again. See you next week.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Who do you want to connect with?
Are you an entrepreneur or intrapreneur looking to build your following?
Welcome to our show.
Follow Me Friday with Joan
and Priya.
Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern
on talkradio.nyc.
We're your digital connectors.
Woo, woo!
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Are you into comics, movies, and pop culture at large? What about music and TV? Then you're in for a treat. This is Michael Dolce, your host on talkingalternative.com. I've been professionally writing comic books, screenplays, and music articles for almost 15 years. Catch my show, Secrets of the Sire, at its new primetime slot, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and get the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. For more info, go to secretsofthesire.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hi, this is Rob Kay.
And I'm Callie Alpert.
And we're hosts of The Rob and Callie Show. Are you looking for a show that talks about real stuff, like life, love, the pursuit of being yourself?
Then you have come to the right place, because we cover topics ranging from chivalry to gratitude to your relationship with money and everything in between.
So listen to us on The Rob and Callie Show, Tuesdays, 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.